water on?
Yep.
Okay, we've come back to open session, and we'll start out with agenda item number two, the executive officer's report.
So, first item, just clarification. We did fail to include some of the items that we said we included in the package you got, so we did send those out as a supplemental package. And I hope you all got that ahead of time with the letter that we received from the Lake Tahoe Partnership. And the response to that, along with some of our issues on your shore, so I'll talk about that when I get to that item there. It was in the supplemental material, and then there were a few just minor clarifications. I think we failed to complete one of the tables that is in the executive officer report. So with that, start to move through here. Item number one. And I don't want to get into a lot of the technical aspects of this because I think it's somewhat self-explanatory. If you have questions about the technical things, but really, I guess what I really want to point out is that the Water Board staff is constantly looking for new tools, new ways to better assess the waters of the region, and I think it's really a good thing that they're reaching out and doing this. It's really important that we have better tools to do our job. And I think part of this EPA grant that was put forward was in large part due to a lot of work on our staff to go out and facilitate that grant for this group. It's not just us. It is TRPA. It is Nevada. So, from that perspective, I think it's good that we're reaching out. The other aspect of this, too, is that many of the tools that we see developed, either on a statewide basis or even sometimes on a federal basis, sometimes don't address the unique waters that we have in the region. And so it's really important that some of these tools are tested, and I think you can see here that we may be doing some modifications to address some of the unique qualities of the waters we have here. And part of this grant will let us do that. The other aspect, too, is, we do have many partners in this. This is not just the Water Board doing things. And, it didn't come out this afternoon much in the discussion, but the Tahoe TMDL was a bi-state TMDL. It wasn't just the Lahontan Water Board doing it. And I think in the Tahoe Basin, it's really important that we develop these collaborative working relationships and maintain them, with our partners in Nevada and work together, because there's always the finger pointing, well, California's doing it differently than Nevada. It sets up different dynamics, and we're trying to really be in sync. And I think working at a technical level on these various issues, I think it's really important to demonstrate that we're really looking at the science regardless of the state land issues. So, on the next one, the variances. This is an annual type thing that goes on in Tahoe, where we have a prohibition about soil disturbance after October 15th. Some years, because of early winter, we don't get too many applications and, frankly, aren't in a position to grant too many variances. This year, and I guess I could say unfortunately, we're not seeing the kind of winter weather that we would normally see. And as a result, we did grant quite a number of variances, and people had the opportunity to do quite a bit of work after October 15th because the conditions were okay for that. So. An example of the kind of things that we do to facilitate some development projects that can utilize the additional month of construction. But it clearly depended on whether, we can predict when the storms are coming in. And, again, this year gave us that ability. We looked out pretty far and didn't want that many storms coming in. So. The next item on that Ball Mountain project. First, I guess I would say is, looking at this and looking at the write-up, looking at all the drilling that's done, around the state, maybe some of you, might be scratching your head a bit about, what's the problem with drilling muds? But we've seen many examples where drilling muds and materials that, you know, from the drills or from a drilling operation aren't properly managed and you know, frankly, do have a significant effect on water quality. And while it's not really described too much in here, I think it sort of talks more about the process we went through, working with the landowner, working with the responsible party. But there's a reason for it, that these things can cause problems if they're not properly managed. You know, and obviously when we were brought into this, it appeared that things weren't being managed very properly and they didn't have a good plan to get this material off-site. So I think it's real important that we got in and worked on this. The other aspect of this, too, that I think, again, people lose sight of, especially with a well of this size. This is a pretty deep well, probably a geothermal well. It's probably quite large to begin with. But it's sort of related also to mining activities. You know, we look at the fact that we have natural minerals in rock. And, you know, when it's in its natural state, it doesn't cause a problem most of the time. But once you bring it up, either because you drilled it up or you mined it and you've broken it up, you know, you expose all these surfaces to the atmosphere. They start to weather. They start to break down. And you get a lot more opportunities to leach constituents that maybe in their native situation aren't causing a problem. But now you've brought them to a place where they can cause problems. And these kind of drilling operations can contribute to that, you know, on a much smaller scale than a mining operation. But the same kind of things go on, same kind of physical chemical activities go on with even, you know, material that's drilled out of the ground and go this deep, this big, there's a lot of material that comes out.
It makes you wonder what kind of relationship the owner had to the driller when the owner called us.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we get brought into these things, and maybe it was more of that than maybe some of the significant water quality issues, but we got this problem dealt with, and everybody's happy that the problem is taken to an appropriate disposal site. The next one, you know, again, is something that we want to keep you appraised of pretty regularly, because I think you hear about it anytime we talk about Tahoe. Is so what's happening with the nearshore? You know, that's the thing. That's the area that everybody sees. Obviously, it's a concern to us. It's a concern to the elected officials. You heard that this afternoon. It's a concern to the business community, because that's what contributes to the recreational benefits of Tahoe, is the visual aspect of Tahoe. And when we see a lot of nearshore problems that create, you know, visual, almost nuisance conditions, you know, people notice it. And people who've been living in Tahoe for a long period of time have seen the deterioration of the nearshore. So, you know, we're working on this. I think we've talked to you a lot about the idea that the current standards that we have really aren't protected. And so we really have to look at this from the point of view of what should the quality of the nearshore look like? What should that, you know, where should we be? And really going through the same kind of exercise that we went through with deep water clarity is, what kind of standards do we want to meet? What's the water chemistry that needs to be met? Is there going to be an alkyl standard in terms of what we're looking for? What's contributing to that situation? Where are the sources? How do we deal with that? And so this is a process to go through, and I think the first aspect of this is, in fact, this research that's being worked on right now. As you can see from the timeline, we should be seeing some products in by mid-2012 that I think will give the board an opportunity to look at this from a standards perspective and start to move towards the analysis of what to do about it, and, you know, how are some of the activities from the TMDL, the permit, going to affect positively the nearshore environment. So we've got that pretty much going on. This was one of the key questions that was raised to us. This is the letter that I mentioned that we failed to include in the package. It specifically addressed the nearshore issue. I don't know if you had a chance to read the letter, but, you know, it's a letter that came out of a partnership that was set up through the federal summit that happened in August, where the senators went out and they really asked the community, not senators directly, but they set up a process where they asked the community, you know, what's of concern to you? And nearshore water quality was one of those things highlighted by people in the community. And so the partnership wrote a letter to the Water Board, to EPA, to NDEP, that Division of Environmental Protection, to TRPA, almost asking the same question. And I think it's good we coordinated the response. As you can see, the response was actually signed by the three entities, the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, US EPA, and us, because we did coordinate, because we're all on the same page trying to solve this problem. And so I think it's, you know, we're looking at this. We obviously are keeping this in a forefront in terms of our work effort. We want to make sure that you stay in the loop on this, because it's something that, from a policy perspective, you're going to be asked these kind of questions, I think, on an ongoing basis. And we need to have good responses as to where we're headed on this. Myers Landfill, quite an extensive write-up of what's been happening with the Myers Landfill. You know, this is an example, I think, of some of our older landfills in the region where we have some problems with them because of various aspects. But, you know, one of the key things with landfills is that there's really two ways that pollutants in the waste get away from the site. One is precipitation that comes down through it. And the second that we're finding more and more of, frankly, is the volatile materials in the waste volatilize, move as a gas until they contact water, and then dissolve in the water. So we're seeing both of those pathways, basically, for constituents to migrate. As indicated here, you know, one of the key things that I think they're doing right in this case is they're trying to stop the source of the material getting away from the landfill. Because you can clean up forever if you don't stop the source. If you stop the source, your chances of doing cleanup in groundwater are much better, probably much shorter, and usually it's a more economical solution in the long term. So, after they tried some groundwater cleanup and it really wasn't really that effective, it's clear they're moving again. Somewhat of an adaptive program. They want to put this new cap on, see what the results are. They, you know, they may have to do some gas recovery. They've talked about a French drain, which is trying to capture groundwater that might move into the landfill and move that around the landfill. So they're trying some good measures to try to, what we call, isolate the waste. So it doesn't contact water, it doesn't get wet, and that water doesn't move those waste constituents off-site. So good things are going on here. I think the one point it's a sort of subtle point in here, and I don't know how most of you caught it or not, but during one of the years of operation, you know, this is a large construction project. And like any other construction project, it takes appropriate BMPs to protect surface waters during construction. And in this case, due to some delays and other things, it appears that El Dorado County didn't do the kind of work they needed to do, and they had a release off-site of some sediment during the wintertime. Again, this is a Forest Service CERCLA-type project, and it's Forest Service land, and there's been a lot of litigation, and that's where El Dorado County has been brought into this to deal with some of the problems. So, we're not sure where this is going to head at this point. Obviously, some analysis of what the effects are of that sediment release is probably appropriate, and it will be done. And then we'll see what that indicates to us in terms of effects. And there may be something down the road in terms of either the Forest Service or the Regional Board pursuing some type of action as a result of that. But at this point, it's probably premature to get into that. The next item has to do with biological objectives, and again, just I think some of you were here when Tom Sook has done some really good presentations on some of the new work that's being done in macroinvertebrate testing and determination of species composition, you know, how many critters are basically in the substrate, as a means of really telling the overall health of the watershed. And these biological water quality objectives is sort of leading on the same line. It also uses other biological indices, such as algae and fish. Those are, you know, things that exist in the water body for long periods of time and give you a long-term representation of the health of the watershed. Sometimes they're much better at indicating health of a watershed than chemical analysis that you take once or twice a year and really just a snapshot of time. So This is, again, some new protocols that are being developed, some new tools that are being used. But the key point of this is looking to the place where we will establish, when I say we, this is a statewide effort, so it probably will be established at the statewide level. But water quality objectives for biological indicators. So we would look at a water body and say, these are the objectives that we want to see in the water. We want to see this diversity of background vertebrate. We want to see these kind of indicators which demonstrate the health of the water body. Much better tools, but they become standards. They become water quality standards. That then we would look and see if discharges are causing problems, point sources are causing problems. But we would use this as a tool to improve the health of the watersheds. And this is going to be pretty controversial because there's different ranges of uses and different ranges of health. And a healthy watershed from a urban area may not be compared very well with a healthy watershed in the Lahontan region. We might have much higher expectations for the health of our watershed. So, we've got two of our staff people, Tom Sook and Alan Miller. And the reason Alan's involved, he is really one of our key players when it comes to the regulatory actions, the permitting that we do. And since once you get the objective, it starts moving into a regulatory permitting perspective. And we really want to make sure that these objectives, can be transferred over into a permit-type process. And so it's real important that we get the scientists, Tom Sook, and the regulator, Alan Miller, talking on the same page and working on a statewide basis to try to develop these objectives that make scientific sense, but also can be translated into permits. And we know both of them are looking out for the fact that we may be looking at different levels of health for different water bodies in the region because of the urbanization that may occur in some areas and not in others. So this is something we all want to follow, and I think it's a real challenge, but I think it'll really improve our knowledge of the health of watersheds in our region and statewide. The next item is talking again about another statewide program that one of your staff, Judith Unsinger, is leading, has been involved in for quite some time on natural sources. And, a little bit of background again on this one is that when we go through our basin plan and look at that historically, we look at the waters in our region and we say, okay, these are the beneficial uses that we want to protect for the waters in our region. And with those beneficial uses come water quality objectives, sometimes chemical standards, sometimes other standards that are necessary to protect that water for that use. And when all the regions developed their basin plans, these were very broad brush approaches. We didn't have a lot of data in many cases to look at some of these situations. Well, what we've been finding, and it's not just to our region, but it's to many regions in the state, is that while we've identified a beneficial use that then brings with it water quality objectives, we may find that there's one or two constituents in a specific water body that are there because of natural sources, and that we can't meet those objectives because of those natural conditions, at least for those one or two constituents. Now, there's a few ways of looking at that. I mean, we could address that either by de-designating beneficial use and getting rid of that use. But, some of these natural sources, yes, they may be affecting the water directly for a use, but we're also looking at protecting that water from other constituents where the water is meeting those standards. And in many cases, some of these natural source waters can be treated if it's used for a drinking water supply. And if you de-designated the use and just allowed more pollution to go into those water bodies, it would be more difficult down the road to use those, and it may actually compromise some of the marginal beneficial uses that we're still seeing with these waters, even though they may not be meeting one or two constituents. So going down that path of de-designating beneficial uses, probably not a good thing to do when we're talking about protecting water quality and trying to protect those uses that we can't protect, even sometimes marginal at best, but we're still protecting them. The other thing we could do is do what we call site-specific objectives, and therefore is just to say, okay, yes, we have all these objectives that sort of come from the beneficial use, but because we've got some natural sources, we're going to raise that level of that constituent in that water body just to address the natural source area. That's a very time-consuming, very resource exercise. Given the number of water bodies in the region and the state that have these problems, we'd rather not go down that path. Now, this whole natural source issue really comes to a head because of the federal 303 or impaired water body listing. Because, again, that listing is very blind in terms of source of pollution. Basically says if you have samples that say that a water body is not meeting the water quality objectives that are in your basin plan, it gets listed as an impaired water body. And you now have to go down this exercise of a TMDL or some other kind of process, when in reality, for these natural sources, we don't think that's an appropriate exercise. So it's really that TMDL listing that in part is causing us to try to address this natural source problem. And what we're trying to do on a statewide basis, and I think Judith has been pushing this for many, many years, is to try to develop a policy that looks at this on a statewide basis and set some criteria by which we don't have to list these as impaired water bodies, even though there may be a natural source that's causing that water body to exceed criteria, maybe in a short stretch, maybe over a longer stretch. We think that's a better exercise to go through, given the nature of what we're seeing in the field and our regulatory constraints and our resource issues. So we're trying to find an avenue for this, and we hope it will have some success. We proposed something a few years ago, and unfortunately the attorneys at the State Water Board didn't feel it was the right way to go, and so we're trying a little different tack, and hopefully by doing this on a statewide basis and bringing the attorneys in early, we can develop something that passes muster from their perspective. The Eagle Lake item, again, just sort of an update of where we are. We went from 644 properties with all on septic tanks, or at least having some kind of septic system, and we're now down to only 45 left. Everybody else has hooked up. So we've made some great strides, thanks to all of you for holding the line on some regulatory actions. But we're getting to the point where we're getting down to some of the holdouts. I think the key that this item brings to your attention is you're going to see some more enforcement action. You're going to see some more proposed AC, cleanup, or cease and desist orders. You may be seeing some administrative civil liability complaints or other actions. To address those people where the board has given them a time schedule, and they still haven't done anything. So this is going to be coming your way, and we hope to move this final push and try to get people hooked up in 2012 so we don't have to spend more resources on this in 2013 and move on to some other things, but it's getting to crunch time with some of the people that are just holding out for whatever reason and not moving forward. So the key thing is you're going to see more, and it's potentially that these are going to be the more controversial ones because they are sort of the holdouts. Yes, please do.
Thank you. I'm Chuck Curtis, Supervisor of the issue. It's because of the enforcement actions and cease and desist orders that you proposed that we're getting this compliance. Today I saw in my mailbox two or three more letters letting people know, yes, we've received the information, but now you are in compliance. So it's even smaller than 45. And as Laura indicated, as we send out the more notices of violations or even if we send out ACL complaints, I think that would be for more people to take action to come to the compliance. So appreciate those actions.
Item 9 talks just quite a bit of detail about the different types of grants and funding opportunities. I think, again, the key point of this, the sort of the take-home message is there are a lot of funding opportunities out there for people that you regulate. And for others who want to do good things in from a water quality perspective, maybe they're not under formal regulation. There's a lot of grant opportunities. There's also low-interest loans. And a lot of your wastewater treatment plants that you regulate constantly use these low-interest loans to fund a lot of their capital improvement projects. So it's been really helpful for many of them to deal with some short-term capital needs and spread that over time in terms of assessments on the individuals that serve the discharge of their system. The other thing I want to just point out to you, and also staff, I think does a wonderful job, frankly, of letting people that we work with on a daily basis know about this. So that's the other part of it is we want to make sure that people are aware of the fact that there are some grant opportunities and low-interest loan opportunities to help them get through some of the regulatory hurdles. The other important part of this, too, which you heard at your last meeting, we were down in the southern part of the region, and you'll hear it again in January, and we're back in the southern part of the region. These salt and nutrient management plans, you heard the one for the Antelope Valley, we're going to hear the one for the Mojave in January. These projects, or these management plans, are being led by the groups that have developed this integrated regional water management plan. And there's a lot of funding available for these integrated regional water management plans. It's helped to coalesce groups in the communities that are looking forward to developing projects, to come in with group funding efforts and group funding requests. But they're also being the leaders on the salt and nutrient management plans. So there's a positive aspect to this funding where some of this funding actually can be used to develop some of these plans. And again, move forward with the idea of trying to manage salt and nutrients on a basin-wide approach, not on an individual discharger approach. And some of these funding efforts are moving that process along. Item 12 is the North Star Supplemental Environmental Project, what's going on there, and I won't go into a lot of the background. But we want to continue to provide you progress as to what's happening and to give you some feedback about the direction you gave us earlier this year about how we should be looking to spend the remaining money in the fund. Clearly, we're looking forward with the vegetation management activities. Those seem to be occurring year after year. They're really doing a good job, I think, of managing the cost of those things and accomplishing quite a bit there. The other aspect of that, there's a little discussion here about the vegetation management handbook. And from the write-up, it does appear now that there's a different funding source for that handbook that will probably be looking more to the Tahoe Basin for some funding there. Some of the components of what's being done in the North Star area may be used in that, but at least from the perspective here is we don't expect to see the vegetation management handbook coming out of this set. It probably will come out of another effort. So we'll keep following that and keep you informed, but that's probably where that's headed. On the Waddell Ranch side of things, again, we're seeing movement in terms of both doing the assessment work that you all authorized at the last meeting, because that will really help us identify, are there really opportunities to do significant watershed improvements that will help water quality? So that's a really important component to prioritize any future funding needs. The other aspect of that is the Watershed Assessment Handbook, that was the fourth component of the SEP, is also moving along, and I think we'll see a product on that shortly. I'm going to skip over the basin plan item. I don't think there's much new on that one. I'm going to cover the third bullet on the Navy when there's a Navy item later here on the agenda for the material. On the Adelanto item, again, just this is sort of an update of what's happened on the cease and desist order. A lot of things on the positive sense have happened. They've submitted many of their reports that were due, and the staff has determined that they're adequate. There is still one outstanding that is being worked on to determine whether it's adequate or not. So we'll look at that. But the other side of it is, you know, that it appears that Adelanto maybe misinterpreted or at least didn't give us a good estimate of some extension that they needed, and it appears that they're going to need some more time to complete one of the reports. So we'll see when that comes in the future and work on that one. But some of these reports sometimes take longer than anybody anticipates, and we'll see when that one comes in and whether it's complete or not. But things do look like they're moving forward, and at least we'll keep you appraised of what's happening with that. The Barstow perchlorate site investigation, again, pretty good write-up about the status of where we are. Positive thing about this, you know, from our perspective, again, is, you know, money goes into the cleanup and abatement account through administrative civil liabilities that the water board's issued. Here again, we're drawing money out to try to deal with a problem where we don't have a financially viable, responsible party at this point, even though work is continuing to try to find one. But one of the big things, the unknowns at this point, is we really don't know how big this perchlorate plume is. And we don't know the potential risk to down gradient receptors. We still have a pretty good sized community down gradient of where we know the plume is, but we're not sure of the risk to them. This contract that's mentioned in here will really help us identify the extent of the plume, how fast it's moving to some extent, and really try to quantify that risk. The work on that will probably start next week or at latest the week after. We have a press release that may have gone out today. Okay, thank you. It was approved this morning, and we just had some logistics to get it out the door. So the press release is out to the community about what's going on. We've communicated informally with the city of Barstow ahead of the press release, so there was no surprises to the city, hopefully, knowing what's coming their way. And, so we'll probably get the results in 2012 at this point by the time they do the field work and do the sampling and prepare the report for us. We'll know more about it in 2012 and see what the next steps are at that point. One of the big challenges in this was that there weren't a lot of public rights of way in the area that we wanted to investigate. And so we actually had to go in and get access agreements with a lot of the landowners. And this was quite an affair with many absentee landowners that don't live on their property, don't even live in California. Some of them are even out of the country. And so we had to ship them access agreements, let their lawyers look at it, go through the whole process. But it was quite an extensive ordeal to get to this point where we have access agreements now with everybody that we need to get onto certain properties and do some of this investigation in places where it makes sense. And so that was one of the aspects that took a little longer than we expected to get to where we are today. This next one, you know, has a little bit to do with the basin plan item that I mentioned earlier. In your triennial basin plan review and allocation of resources, we have brought to you the concept that the Navy really wanted to come in and ask for a review of a beneficial use designation of the groundwater in the area. And they made a case to you that this was really important to them as part of their ultimate decision on remedial measures. You authorized the resources for us to work with them on that. A little while later, they decided to back off of that request. And they weren't sure where they were headed at that point, but they sort of put in a hiatus, I guess, their request to us, and really weren't working with us much on this. And just recently, I think they've reestablished some communication with us, and as indicated in here, they're prepared to spend some funds to gather some of the data that would support their request for a de-designation of some of the groundwater in the area. You know, clearly this is one that there's a water board resolution that specifies very specific water quality standards for municipal water supplies, for designating a water body as a municipal water supply. And the Navy believes that area doesn't meet those standards. So that's part of this process is to go through and see if they can make their case from a technical perspective, and also see what the boundaries are. Because a lot of, that's the difficult part with a lot of these aquifers is part of them are okay, and part of them may have a high salt content, which would clearly put them out of that that range of being within the municipal designated water supply. So we have to look at that, but we really think it's up to the Navy to make their technical case, and we'll see where the data drives us. The next one, again, talks briefly about the support that's being done at Borax, one of the mining activities that we regulate in the southern part of the region. There's a lot of improvements going on at many of our large mining operations. One of the items further in the EO report is the Molly Core mine, where again they're going through some reevaluation of mining activities, trying to modify some of their waste disposal ponds and other things to improve them. And so we're going to see a lot more permitting type activities as it relates to mining. I'm frankly surprised we haven't seen more activity in the gold mining side of things, given the price of gold. We've seen a few, but we don't seem to be moving that quickly, given what we've seen in the past when gold prices seem to go up. The next one, again, is just some information about a statewide project being looked at. I think many of you remember that the board had to permit Nursery Products, which is a composting operation just outside of Hinckley. That was quite a controversial issue. I know there was a number of people from the public that stood up and were quite vehement about objecting to the permitting of that site. The State Board is looking at trying to figure out whether they can issue statewide permits or statewide waivers for specific types of operations. And they've identified composting as one of those operations that they think is amenable to that kind of statewide regulation. I think, frankly, from our perspective, we have some concerns about that as to, you know, how do you evaluate a specific operation and look at the potential waste that might be produced at that site in reference to the groundwater quality and the potential for leaching. Most of our landfill mining activities are really site-specific in nature, and this is similar to that in terms of the potential for water quality risk. And so we've got a little concern about where they're headed, and our staff's is monitoring it pretty closely, but we'll see where it goes, and we'll see if the State Board figures a way out to deal with it.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add that I heard from Patrice that Brianna Bergen, who worked on the Nurse Products permit, has been going to these, and Patrice received some kudos from the State Board staff that they really appreciate the level of expertise we brought to the room, and just the whole, you know, everything, all the lessons learned we had over Nurse Products is really helping, and I think she's been really good at being able to explain that to the State Board staff, and so I think, you know, the whole effort is going to be better because of our involvement in this effort. So this is kudos for our staff and expertise. So, yeah.
I have a question about that. I mean, there could be, I'm wondering what amount of contamination of hazardous and toxic substances is allowed to be in waste sent to composting facilities.
I guess I'd say, you know, looking at the Nursery Products, you prohibited hazardous waste from being sent or accepted at that facility. So we're not really talking about hazardous levels of constituents in the waste being brought in. But we are talking about green waste. We are talking about sewage sludge.
Yeah, but sewage sludge can contain all kinds of problems.
Yes, it can. But again, the levels that are being accepted at these sites, there are some minimum levels that have to be met before the sludge can be accepted at these sites. So, yes, the hazardous concern is not there, but there are constituents of concern, both in the sludge that's coming out there and in the green waste as it's being processed, in terms of some of the aspects of that we're concerned about from a groundwater perspective, and in some cases, surface water. So, you know, there is some concern, and you know, I think that's really why, you know, from the Nursery Products perspective, we asked you to look at that in a pretty conservative way. And I think, you know, the permit that you adopted is protective of water quality. Maybe overly so to some extent, but I think in part there wasn't a lot of information to work with in terms of site-specific conditions, and the company wanted a permit pretty quickly, and so they acquiesced, I guess, to maybe more standards that may have been appropriate if they gave us a lot more information. So, you know, I think that's the problem that I sort of pointed out before, is these are a lot of site-specific issues, and to try to deal with this on a general waiver or general waste discharge requirements, you know, where does it leave the discretion to look at a lot of these issues and try to fit them into the right kind of isolation, I guess, of the material being processed, and what happens to stormwater runoff, especially in the desert where you get some very flashy events that need to be dealt with. So, you know, again, there's all kinds of situations in the state, and I think, as Lori said, you know, the state board needs a little dose of reality sometimes in terms of what we at the region see and how we try to deal with them, how we deal with them in Region 6 and how they deal with them in Region 5 or other regions. Maybe slightly different, but they're different because of the environmental conditions we're working on. So that's going to be the difficult challenge, I think, from the state board in trying to put together a statewide permit for this kind of operation. If you hadn't noticed, I did 19 as a repeat of a prior item, so I won't go into that one again. On the wetland restoration effort in Mono County, this is something we bring to you on a regular basis in terms of trying to look at what's happening in Mono County with projects that are going forward, mostly single-family residences in subdivided areas where the lots were divided years ago, and many of the lots are mostly, if not all, in wetlands. And I think the board many years ago determined that it really wasn't appropriate to try to look at these on an individual basis, but the county stepped forward and said, you know, we will do the restoration activities that are needed to mitigate for some of these smaller activities. We think it's going so far pretty well. You know, Cindy's is staying on top of it. Obviously, there's some questions. It appears that, you know, some training is needed from some of the locals' perspective, and I think we're trying to provide that. We also, some of our other staff is also working with Cindy and with the county, Toby Tyler and Jan Zimmerman from our two different offices have been working with the county and working with some of the local entities, the Corps of Engineers, bringing them in to help the county really understand the permitting process and what's needed to identify wetlands ahead of time and looking at it from a mitigation perspective. So it's something we just want to keep working on and keep our finger on, but it seems to be working at this point pretty well, but we don't want to lose sight of it. The next item is PG&E, and I'll just make a few introductory comments, and maybe I'll let Lori Kemper talk a little bit more, but I'll just comment briefly on the replacement water order that was issued a few months ago. So far, there's been some progress moving along. On the other side of it, PG&E has filed a petition, both requesting a stay of the order and then a review of the order after that. But we are working on that at this point to put that together. On the other side, in terms of what's been happening to comply with the order, PG&E has submitted all of the required reports that are due by now on a pretty regular basis. I think one of the key perspectives is they have demonstrated that the water they're providing, the bottled water replacement, meets the standards that were specified in the cleanup abatement order. They've given us a management plan indicating how they will continue to provide high-quality water to those people that are getting the bottled replacement water. The other issue that we're still working on is one of the provisions of the order was that PG&E was to propose some kind of statistical methodology to look at changes in groundwater quality in individual domestic wells that are below the background level of the 3.1 but above the 0.02 public health goal. And PG&E just recently submitted that report to